You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, March 25th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, good evening. How's everyone?
Good.
Great. How you doing, Ev?
Good. Oh, you're talking to us? Oh, we're good.
Yes. No, I'm talking to the wall.
Rebecca is off this week, but it is not her fault. What happened was the power supply in my computer decided to short circuit for some reason. And I was without a computer for a couple of days. We had to delay, at the last minute, we had to delay the recording date. And Rebecca had a previous engagement, something about libel reform in the UK. So unfortunately, she can't make it tonight.
Steve, did you see and smell smoke?
I did. I saw and I heard that sound that you would hear on a soundtrack of this is the sound of electronics frying. That you know, I mean, it was literally and you know, the lights on
classic.
My computer were sort of flashing in time with the noise.
Oh no.
Yeah.
So 2 days without a computer. Did you get like the DTs?
It was rough. Then I had to hook everything back. I had such a tangle behind my computer. And of course, I find a power supply that's hooked up to nothing. And I have no memory.
Power cord hooked up to power cord.
It's like it's plugged in and there's a end that should plug into something else. But I have no idea
what it was like a camera or something? Like you did, how many years ago did you use that thing?
Or an old hard drive or something. I don't know.
Or maybe it was cloaked. You just couldn't see it.
Right.
You were connected to the cloud, obviously.
Man, you're lucky. That your house could have caught on fire from that.
Yeah, it was a good thing I was actually at my computer when it happened, so I could unplug it right away. Yeah.
So we're back up and running.
Back up and running.
Yep.
Tell us what's special about today, Evan.
Well, it was 1903, and the Times newspaper, it doesn't say what country, though. Maybe there's a Times newspaper in France, because it was reported that French physicist Pierre Curie, assisted by Madame Curie, communicated to the Academy of Sciences that recently discovered radium, and I'm quoting now, possesses the extraordinary property of continuously emitting heat without combustion, without chemical change of any kind, and without any change to its molecular structure, which remains spectroscopically identical after many months of continuous emission of heat, such that the pure radium salt would melt more than its own weight of ice every hour. A small tube containing radium, if kept in contact with the skin for some hours, produces an open sore by destroying the epidermis and the true skin beneath, and the cause of death of living things whose nerve centers do not lie deep enough to be shielded from their influence.
Oh, man, that's scary.
Radiation, baby.
Radiation, yeah.
Wow. It's just weird to hear someone describe radiation that way.
Right, like they have no idea what it is. We're obviously familiar with it.
Just kind of describing kind of what it does and it could.
So do you guys think
death,
if you were exposed to enough radiation in order for it to do that to your skin, can that give you cancer and kill you as well?
Oh, yeah.
I think it depends on the radiation, but yeah, my guess would be yeah.
It'd certainly be a risk factor for cancer, yeah.
Oh, man.
And radium, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm no chemist, but I understand that's pretty radioactive.
And sadly, she died of radiation poisoning.
Yeah.
Yes. Took one for the team.
Or how about those women who used to paint the phosphorus numbers onto, what was it, watches or some sort of devices?
Yeah.
They would lick the tips of their brushes as they dip it in the phosphorus and paint it on, and they got poisoned. Ugh.
How about that guy was it the guy that was selling radioactive water when they thought radiation was nifty and, you know, like sci-fi?
Well, there was like a muscle man who was a shill for radioactive tonic, and which he drank, and eventually, like, his jaw was eaten away by radioactivity and suffered horribly from it.
I mean, didn't they remove his bottom jaw?
Yeah.
Or it fell off?
Ouch.
Could you imagine?
How does one acquire radioactive liquid?
What they would do is they would literally have like a vase made out of radium, and your instructions were to put water in it overnight and then drink water from the basin or vase or whatever. That's how they would do it.
Come a long way in 110 years.
Yeah. One quick announcement before we get on to the news items. April 17th, Saturday, 10 a.m., New York City. The NexusCon, the Northeast Conference of Science and Skepticism, You can go to the NECSSCON.org and register for the event. So get tickets while some are left. The speakers this year include James Randi, DJ Grothy, Jamie Ian Swiss, George Hreb, Steve Mirsky, David Gorski, Val Jones, John Snyder, Kimball Atwood, Julia Galef, and the entire cast of the SGU. It's going to be a lot of fun. You can also register for a speaker's dinner where you get to sit down and have dinner with all of the speakers. So please check it out and register. It's coming up pretty quickly. So, Bob, tell us about the rise of the dinosaurs.
Oh, no, where? Oh, you mean, okay, never mind.
Yeah, this was a pretty cool story, news item. Any fifth grader can probably tell you how the reign of the dinosaurs ended, right? Aliens came down, they seeded the earth with human DNA and yep. ate all the dinosaurs. Wait, that's not the consensus yet, is it? But, well, you know what it is. Well, if you ask the same kid how dinosaurs began their dominance, you'd probably get a puzzled look more than anything else. So it's a bit ironic that just last month, scientists made their most definitive statement yet about the fate of dinosaurs, that they almost certainly, right, they died from an asteroid yep. and not volcanism. Now, an international team led by Brown University paleobiologist Jessica Whiteside, they've concluded that the other end of the dinosaur reign, namely when they took over, was caused almost certainly from volcanism and not an asteroid, kind of the opposite.
Right.
Bob, when you say volcanism, what do you mean specifically?
You know, Vulcans come – no, just volcano, volcanoes, Jay. Just volcanoes and – volcanoes and – and, you know, vents in the earth that release lava, you know.
Sulfur and stuff.
Yeah, gases and stuff.
Gases.
200 million years ago, the earth was a bit different than it is today, right? Most of the land masses were smushed together into a supercontinent called Pangaea.
Thank you.
Which was actually very good, Jay. Which was just actually starting to break up, actually, about 200 million years ago. It had been together for quite some time.
Well, all relationships ended at some point, Bob.
But also, at that time, 200 million years ago, Kuro-Tarsans ruled the planet. Now, Kuro-Tarsans were a branch of reptiles distinct from dinosaurs. You don't really hear too much about these guys. They actually coexisted with dinosaurs and early, you know, proto-dinosaurs for 30 million years. But the early dinos were probably second-class reptiles back then. Kuro-Tarsans were the biggest, most dominant animals during the Triassic period. Even in terms of sheer diversity, they were ahead of their reptile cousins. Then something happened. One of the great mass extinctions of all time occurred, which ended the Triassic and ushered in the Jurassic. And the scientists now believe that as North America separated from the Africa plate, you know, imagine these two plates have been together for quite some time, and they start separating because the tectonic plates are you know, slowly moving. So they're slowly separating, and it creates a basin. As they're separating, there's a basin that is created between them, and which would later become the Atlantic Ocean. In this basin, there were fissures, which released greenhouse gases that wiped out half the plant species on the planet and many animals, including most of the Kuro-Tarsans. So that's pretty much what they think would happen. But like any mass die-off, this opened up tons of ecological niches, right, for the dinosaurs to spread into and eventually led to their world domination for about, 200 million years. It was an amazing run that they had. So all of this started then, not necessarily because they were inherently superior, as many people believed, but essentially they were really just lucky.
Yeah.
I'll give you a quote from Jessica Whiteside. She's the assistant professor of geological sciences. She said that they had the blind luck of being unwittingly adapted to get through that climate catastrophe. How they did it is quite difficult to explain. So that little bit of luck paved the way for world dominance for millions of years. But we all know eventually, right, they met a similar fate to the Kuro-Tarsans. They were wiped out 65 million years ago, leaving only modern-day birds in their wake. The Kuro-Tarsans left a legacy as well. Can you guys guess what their legacy is?
29.
Close. You're very close, Jay. No, actually, you're not. You're so far away, I don't know what to say. Their legacy is the 23 species of crocodiles, alligators, and gorilles that exist today. And even the number 23 surprised me. There's actually 20, you know, you think crocodile, you think alligator. There's actually 23 species of those guys, so there's a lot. And boy, they were much more diverse 200 million years ago. Imagine if they weren't wiped out. the species that they would have evolved into. So perhaps in tens of millions of years from now, only a small residue of mammals will still be around. My cynical side guesses that that residue will probably consist of robotic terminators looking for the last bit of biology to wipe out.
Right. Now, Bob, this is a consensus that's been building for a while, because I think we talked about this like a year ago, the fact that the dinosaurs were just lucky in terms of beating
right.
the Tarsans out, right? Well, let's go on to another bit of paleontological news. This one is really interesting. Do you guys know how many different species of humans there have been on the Earth?
How many different species of humans?
Yes.
Homo sapien. Homo erectus.
Erectus. Homo sapiens.
Well, is Neanderthal part of it?
Habilis.
Oh, right. Habilis. Homo habilis.
There's a few of them, but I know there's one more.
So the genus has had, you know, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Homo sapiens. But if you're talking about close relative to Homo sapiens, now whether or not you call them like Homo sapiens neanderthalensis or Homo neanderthalensis is, I guess, still, I'm not sure if that's actually been finally settled. But I thought that there were two, modern humans and Neanderthals. There's a third that's been controversial over the last few years, but the evidence seems to be heading towards the fact that the Hobbit, Homo floresiensis, a nickname the Hobbit, may be a third human species, and a fourth was possibly just discovered.
That's incredible.
This is really cool.
Yeah, well, this is the specimen is called Woman X.
And really?
Woman X, yes. Has not been named as a species yet. The specimen comes from Siberia about 40,000 years ago, and they managed to isolate some DNA, specifically mitochondrial DNA, from the pinky.
Hence the woman, right?
No, men and women both have mitochondria. Mitochondria,
yeah, but it's passed on, but mitochondrial DNA is passed on through the mothers.
Yeah, it's only inherited mostly, 99% or so whatever,
right.
through the maternal line. Yeah, but the specimen, that's not why we know the specimen's a woman, though. But anyway, they're working on the nuclear DNA. They haven't nailed that yet. But after analyzing the mitochondrial DNA, they basically were trying to figure out, was this specimen a Neanderthal or a modern human? And there's different genetic markers that we have now because we've sequenced enough of the Neanderthal genome. And it actually was neither. It's clearly human, but not either Neanderthal or Homo sapiens.
How awesome is that?
It's a fourth species. And they estimate, now this kind of genetic estimation is rough. There's a lot of, you know, assumptions that go into the analysis. But based upon the genetic analysis, they estimate that this lineage broke off from the human lineage, from our ancestors, about 1 million years ago. Whereas Neanderthals split
that's
off
big.
About 500,000 years ago, about half a million years ago. Yeah, that's a long time ago. And yet it persisted till about 40,000 years ago. You know, because 40,000 years ago, there were four living human species.
Damn, we missed out.
Yeah.
That would have been so cool if there were more humans.
Yeah, within about 5,000 years, three of them went extinct and we were the only ones left.
Wow. So, Steve, if they existed that short amount of time ago, how come we haven't found more fossils?
Yeah, that's a good question. So they think that this probably represents a completely separate migration of early human ancestors out of Africa. And then for a million years, they lived in isolation, becoming their own species, but then died out, 40,000 years ago. So it seems as if, each one of these human species may, have been genetically isolated and formed, their own species because they were separate migrations out of Africa.
Yeah.
It probably is just that their range was not very far. They may have settled in around Siberia, but not spread out to, like Asia and Europe and whatever, to the point that we would find a lot of their sites. But the fossil sites that we have are so sporadic. It makes you wonder, maybe there are some of their sites out there, that are waiting to be discovered.
I hope so.
Well, you'd figure there'd be more near the location where they found the original, right?
You would. I mean, obviously, it would be a good place to look. I mean,
I'm sure you can bet your butt that they're going to start. They're going to start looking.
Steve, did they find it by accident, or did they predict that they would find something like this near there?
Oh, I don't think anyone predicted this. Yeah, this is totally out of the blue that there's a new species.
It was a pinky bone, right? Just
it was
a pinky bone.
Yeah.
You know what? It's a good thing that I don't stumble on these bones.
Yeah, I mean, most people would not recognize what they are.
I probably wouldn't even be able to recognize it as a bone if I saw it, you know? I just wouldn't even...
Well, now we have mitochondrial DNA from Neanderthals, right?
Yes.
Okay, so did anyone mention how different they were, in comparison? You know, is it vastly different from either of the other two, or is it closer to Neanderthal than us or closer to us? Did any hint of that kind of relationship come out?
It's different from both. You would imagine that since it split off 500,000 years before Neanderthals and humans split off, it should
You're
be
right.
equidistant from the two, right?
Right, right.
And it looks like there were a lot of other hominid bones in the cave that they're investigating, not just a pinky bone. And there were human settlements in the area as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's from contemporary? I mean, were they contemporaries?
Probably, because it says that there was occupation in that area for about 125,000 years, so it probably overlapped, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Very cool.
I hope we find some more. I want to see what they...
I mean, that makes sense. Evolution's a bush, not a ladder, right? So, you expect these kind of speciation events to happen, and humans were in the process of... migrating around the world, so I would expect you're going to get isolated, populations here and there, forming enough differences to be a different subspecies or species. So it kind of makes sense that we're going to find this,
and maybe a fifth one someday.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, on some island somewhere or just in one region. You know, if they were isolated long enough, you'd expect that. So it would not be surprising at all. Well, let's move on to the next item. This is also a paleontological item. I guess it's a sort of a theme this week, but this one's a fake item. Right, Evan?
Can you spot the fake? That's right. We have an update on the Star Child project, and I have some theme music to go
along. It's actually a project?
It's like the Alan Parsons Project.
There's a star.
There you go. Some of our listeners might remember that tune from the 70s called Starman. So we've adopted that as the official theme music for the Star Child Project update. Now, who knew there was a Star Child Project update? I thought this thing was put to bed so many years ago.
Oh, no. Lloyd Pye's not giving up on this thing. No way.
Lloyd Pye is the man responsible for this. So here's what he has. He has in his possession a skull. A skull, a skull of a child, and it shows some pretty, interesting malformations. It's like a swollen head. The facial cavities are kind of all crushed in towards the middle. Lord Pye believes that this is evidence of an alien race, or an alien race that visited Earth and co-mingled with humans, shall we say. So a hybrid of some kind.
It's a hybrid. Half human. Yeah, I would imagine that if it looks so similar to a normal human skull, a normal child's human skull, yeah, there has to be some kind of mix, right? Like, what else would the explanation be?
What else could the explanation be, in fact, right?
Interestingly, so yeah, this is taken at face value, right? There are those who have accused this of actually being like a hoax or a fraud. But if we say, all right, the skull itself is genuine, and I think it dates to about 600 years ago.
900 years ago.
900 years
plus,
ago. Thank
plus
you.
Or minus 40 years. Yep.
900 years ago. It has all of the anatomical features of a human skull, but distorted or deformed. Right. They're all there. There's the parietal bone, the temporal bone, frontal bone. They're all there, just deformed. Occam's razor, I think, would dictate that this is therefore a deformed human skull, right? There's no pieces that are not supposed to be there. There's no significant pieces missing. It's just, you know, if you were able to like take a picture of a human skull in Photoshop and then move everything around, you know, this is, you could get to something like this.
Right.
Plus, it's made of bone too. It's not made out of some funky material.
Yeah, well, they claim that there are these red fibers in there, but again, we don't have any analysis of them to tell us what they are.
Although we do have the claim from Lloyd Pye that he has shared it with 50 experts, and mm-hmm. he won't tell us who any of these experts are, but that's okay. He's consulted 50 experts on it, and none of them can adequately explain the Star Child's appearance mm-hmm. on the basis of any kind of natural deformity.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Can you spot the logical fallacy?
Yes.
Pye's entire approach to this project is a massive argument from ignorance. And he makes that fallacy over and over again. Initially, they tried to extract nuclear DNA from the bone. And they were able to extract...
mitochondrial DNA.
Well, they were able to get mitochondrial DNA that was from a human. And it seems as if that was the kid's mother. They were unable to extract nuclear DNA. This was a few years ago. And Lloyd Pye's conclusion was the reason they couldn't extract nuclear DNA proves that it's not human.
Oh, nice.
So the lack of evidence is evidence that this is not human.
Right out of the gate, you make a discovery like this, you bring it to, you know, quote unquote, experts, right? You let scientists look at it that do this for a living, that have been doing it for a long time, which he's failed to do. You know, he's not.
I disagree. You find something like this, you put it on eBay.
The Smithsonian will pay you more for this than most people would imagine paying on eBay. But
Well, then they could bid on it.
The point being that right out of the gate, he's made poor decisions on top of poor decisions, and that's if he's actually even being honest at all, which I doubt.
Well, Jay, I think it's a good point, and I think the maybe a larger point to all this is that Lloyd Pye has some preconceived notions, right? And he is emphasizing certain points that, you know, help him try to make his case, and he downplays any evidence that contradicts what his personal values is, in, you know, invested in this whole Star Child project. So he's biased. He's horribly biased from the get-go. And that taints everything.
Remember, this is the guy who wrote the book, Everything You Know Is Wrong. Right? This guy thinks that everything scientists say is completely wrong. You know, he wants to rewrite history and rewrite science.
One of those.
He's a total crank, this guy, bottom line.
But just last week, and I'll read it in his own words, Lloyd Pye says, we finally have a recovery of nuclear DNA from the Star Child.
So
that's the
what update. Scientist confirmed it? Where's the information?
Okay. Well, he met with the geneticist working on the Star Child's DNA, and he notes, I should add that I can't reveal the name of the geneticist or where he works until we are ready to formally present his results.
Of course, because that would ruin everything.
This guy is full of shit.
There you go. He's totally marketing himself. This is all hype and no substance.
Probably, yeah.
All right, so he admits, you know, back in 2003, they had a DNA analysis that used human-only primers to recover the mitochondrial DNA, right? Which is the DNA outside the nucleus. But at the time, they could not recover it because the technology at the time, I guess, was limited.
Lame.
Right. But now in 2010, there have been many improvements in the recovery process. Those improvements have been applied to the Star Child skull with a stunning result. And he throws up some charts and he talks about sequencing and base pairs. Steve, this is where you're probably going to have to jump in and explain a little bit. But essentially what he is saying is that there's a strand of 342 base pairs to which they are not able to match it up to any animal in the NIH database, which contains, I guess, all this information on all kinds of animals and their genetic codes.
Right. I mean, Pye says every animal in the world, and that's wrong, right? I mean, so he's trying to say that this database basically contains the genetic information of all living things on Earth, and since this thing can't be matched to anything in the database, that proves this is DNA not from the Earth.
Oh, wow, this guy's a genius.
Yeah. Again, we don't know what this is, therefore it's an alien. No, we don't know what this is, therefore what? We don't know what it is. And
plus 342 base pairs is nothing. That's tiny.
Well,
that,
no,
that could just be junk DNA that it's not coding for anything that we know, you know, that's
Lloyd Pye believes that to be a stunning and apparently incredibly rare occurrence.
Now the thing is, I mean, that is long enough to match up to known, you know, we should be able to see. If it were a human, we should be able to find out where that's supposed to match up along the human genome. Mm-hmm. But you know, certainly there could be things mixed in there that are not from people, and it wouldn't necessarily be in that database. Who knows? They could have got. I mean, they described the process. They're supposed to get rid of any contamination, but if any bacterial DNA got in there, you know, that would throw it off. Also, this analysis has not been peer reviewed. We don't even know who the geneticist is. There's no transparency here whatsoever.
He could be making this up wholesale. We have no idea.
Or it could just be incompetence. It could have been problems with the process. You know, who knows? And this is a negative result. This is just nothing. Now, here's the other thing. He consults all these experts, right? But if you read for those experts who have actually, like, you can say this is a quote of Dr. So and so. Most of them are saying things which are don't have anything to do with whether or not this is a human or an alien hybrid. Just like this is 900 years old from the carbon-14 dating. That's what expert A is saying. That's one expert. Another one saying that this looks like it comes from a child, you know, based on the teeth, maybe 5 to 6 years old. That's another expert. Mm-hmm. So, but they're not saying anything that bears at all on whether or not this is a deformed human versus a human alien hybrid. But he's counting them among the experts. There's only one so-called expert, a craniofacial surgeon, who has allegedly examined the skull directly and ruled out all of the known, you know, medical deformities that could explain the skull. It's just this one guy. You know, and who seems to be invested in this,
right?
And we don't really know what his expertise is.
Hardly a scientific.
I mean, if you think about the hoopla that this guy's making over a deformed skull, it's just a deformed skull. Obviously, the kid. If this is a real skull, it was a child that had some type of genetic disease.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, in fact, a very interesting skull from a medical, you know, historical point of view. Maybe there were two things going on. You know what I mean? Like maybe he had hydrocephalus and they bound his head. Maybe they thought that was a treatment for the hydrocephalus. Or he had some genetic disorder with that had megencephaly, you know, an enlarged head or whatever. I mean, it's some unique mutation that we don't see anymore for some reason.
And Steve, they discovered a Y chromosome in the mix, so they knew it was a boy, right? Hence the Y chromosome. And nothing Lloyd Pye offers goes to explain how the Y chromosome got in there.
Right. So the Y chromosome had to come from a human male, and he also had a human mother. And somehow Pye, you know, argues in his head that that means the father was alien.
You know what's so sad is if they just brought this skull to one of the thousands of experts on the planet, that, you know, give them an hour with it and they'll give you an arm's length list of reasons why everything he says is full of shit, right? Like, it's just that easy.
If this were serious, this would require some transparent scientific analysis, not this shenanigans that he's going through. And also, the skull doesn't have a provenance. You know what I mean? We don't know, like, who dug it up when with a dated archaeological find. You know what I mean? It sort of came out of nowhere, and that's always...
Yeah, the backstory behind it is fuzzy. No one's exactly sure how he got a hold of this thing.
It's, skull comes, you know, out of nowhere and ends up in the hands of a notorious crank. What are the odds, you know, of that happening? Plus, let's not ignore, you know, the elephant in the room with Pye's argument. He's saying that there's alien DNA and that it would be compatible with human DNA so that you can have an actual hybrid, right? That's just completely implausible. As Sagan said, you would have an easier time crossing a human with a petunia than anything that evolved off this earth. You know, even mitochondria, which are symbiotic in our own cells, their DNA is slightly off from the nuclear DNA and wouldn't be able to interbreed. You know what I mean? So it's just absurd on its face.
I want to read to you the last little part of the announcement that he sent out, and here's what he said. The expenses for material during our research has now outstripped the amount donated by the list. It's now coming out of my pocket. I could use some help to bridge that gap.
Mm-hmm.
But we're close, right? I mean, where have we heard that before? Oh, God, we're close. We're about to make this announcement.
Yeah.
We're just short on some funds. Maybe if we could get some people to reach into their pocket, you know, it'll help carry us over the finish line here. Where have we heard that before?
Right.
Dennis Lee. So he's taking a page out of, you know.
It's just so although I have to say, legitimate researchers do that too. I mean, when they're, you know, they're applying for their next cycle of funding, right? This is like that joke.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, in 5 years, we'll have solved all of our problems. Mm-hmm. You know, in the next, you know, funding cycle, we will have achieved X, Y, and Z. So anyway, anyone looking for funding is going to play that game a little bit.
Except it would be nice if he had something to bring to the table at this point and then ask for money. He's got
right, but nothing. But if you're going to ask for money, you should have complete transparency, which we don't have here.
So that's the update on the Starchild
project. Yeah, and you know, he promises when the analysis is complete, they'll go public, including the, you know, the name of the geneticist who's doing the analysis. So yeah, we'll see when the data is all presented.
Yeah.
But I'm not holding my breath. Well, let's move on to Who's That Noisy?
Who's That Noisy? Should we play last week's Who's That Noisy?
Let's.
No, we don't need to hear that again.
Yeah, we do.
I'll make the noise. Ready?
Very interesting one this week, Evan. What was that?
Jiffy Pop popcorn. No. But on a tangent to that, ever heard of popcorn shrimp? Ever heard of snapping shrimp?
I have.
Alpheus heterocalius.
What are they cooking in, like an Alfredo sauce, or what do we got?
Right? Delicious. They're found in tropical and temperate seas. They're about 2 inches long, these shrimp. They have claws that grow to half the size of their entire body length. And it's the claws that give off that snapping sound. And when you get a lot of these things together, oh, man, it gets loud.
So those are actually the shrimp's tiny little claws making that noise when, like, thousands of them do it, right?
Yep. And it's been known that these, when you get a lot of these things together, and it is making that sound altogether, it interferes with sonar of naval vessels.
Wow.
Right? I mean, so imagine that.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be the loudest animal noise, that, you know, a group of them doing that all together.
Yeah, the greatest sound density of any animal.
Yeah.
At least underwater, from what I could tell. I couldn't tell if that meant all animals. But there was one person who got it correct. And from the message board,
wow.
Worm Guy.
Hey, Worm Guy.
Worm Guy.
Yeah, a lot of wrong guesses this week, I noticed.
A lot of wrong
guesses.
That
was tough.
What were
some of the guesses?
A lot of burning this and burning that, you know.
Right.
It sounded like a
crackling
of fire
or something.
Yeah. What do you got for this week?
This week, we have the following. So, see if you can name this noise.
First, we learn from Bernoulli that when a moving fluid like air encounters a constriction, that is a narrow space, the velocity increases.
Wow.
What? Oh, man, that guy's awesome. He's so off the hook, right?
Oh, man, that sounds so familiar.
Didn't it,
yes.
Steve? Oh, man.
It should be familiar to, I think, you guys.
That's a good one, Evan. All right, let's do a couple of questions. The first question comes from Bill Ellis from Greensboro, North Carolina. And he wrote a rather long email, but I'm going to cut to the end where he makes the point that I want to address. He writes, "Now for something critical I've been wanting to write you about for a while. Sometimes I wish you guys at the podcast would realize that many of your listeners are not scientists. Probably many are curious evangelical Christians like myself who enjoy the debate and the topical content of the podcast but don't like being called names or ridiculed. I've learned a lot from you guys, but I've also had to learn to filter out some of the attitude, the generalizations and judgments you dish out to get to the good stuff from the podcast. We are evangelical Christians, but we're people too, and that was not factor in the very difficult decision we made to homeschool. We can't wait to take our kids to see the Spitzer Human Origins exhibit in D.C. this year. Please don't assume that most homeschoolers are ignorant of the truth of evolution or other such topics. We can't control what the book publishers put out. So what do you say, guys? Open up your tent just a bit. We're listening too. So it's always interesting for us to get feedback from people who are not your typical skeptics, you know, the people who are in the skeptical community that we're usually, whether consciously or unconsciously, talking to when we're doing the podcast. But we do know that there are believers of all stripes who listen to the podcast. We occasionally get emails, and we've read, I think, at least a couple of them on the show from people who say that they started listening to the show expecting to disagree with us, and then, you know, we sort of won them over to the skeptical point of view, and we definitely want to be accessible to people who are not already skeptics, although, you know, we know that they're our core audience. I wrote back to Bill to thank him for writing, and also say that, you know, we do part of the purpose of our show is to try to open up the tent, if you will, of the skeptical movement, but also to let him know that we do very consciously walk a fine line, very deliberately. There are those who deserve ridicule, and we don't pull our punches when it comes to criticizing pseudoscience or anti-science. However, we tend to reserve our harsh criticism for the promoters of pseudoscience, for people who are actively out there, you know, either trying to weaken the teaching of science or evolution in the public schools, or like Don McElroy, for example, in Texas. People who are engaged, you know, with the public debate, not your rank and file believer, right? Not the average person, you know. We're trying to educate them. That's our only goal. We also do try, although I admit we probably fail from time to time, to really focus on the arguments, not the people. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you might say that like creationism is dumb. Doesn't necessarily mean that every creationist is dumb. In my opinion, most creationists are just misinformed. You know, grossly misinformed most of the time. And that's something that's fixable. You know, that's fixable with education. Whether they'll be open to, you know, information from another source is another matter.
Yeah. See, the emailer is right, though. I mean, I could speak for myself on this one. I think my attitude from time to time dips in to cynicism and derision on the show, sure, and I admit it. You know, I don't want to be biased, and I try not to be. I just hope that anyone that listens to the show understands that. You know, I think we all have our own opinions and bias and everything that we try to keep out the politics and religion as much as possible, but it sneaks in.
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, the other thing to consider is that in the broader society, skeptics, you know, self-identified skeptics and non-believers are in the minority and often feel as if we are a beleaguered minority. You know, it's, and therefore whenever you get a group like that together, you know, we tend to cater to our worldview, you know. Part of, you know, that, and definitely I think we consciously are celebrating the skeptical worldview. There's no question about that. And we're actually very consciously trying to make it okay for skeptics to be outspoken, you know, and we will often get emails from people. It's like, oh, what do I do? Like, we just got an email from a high school student who said that, you know, a Scientologist from Narconon came into the class and started like teaching them nonsense, about, you know, drugs being all poisons and things like that. And he wanted to know what to do. I'm like, you know, dude, complain, you know, tell your parents, go complain to the principal. You know, your teacher, wittingly or unwittingly, allowed a shill for a dangerous cult to come into the schools to spread their ideology, and you're the skeptic, you know, who sees it for what it is. You know, if you're up to it, do something about it. You know,
yeah.
So you know that's also part of our show as well. Yeah. So there's a little bit of a culture clash going on. I do give Bill credit for putting up with that and being patient enough to listen to the good bits, you know, where we're just talking about science and not more of the cultural stuff.
You're right, Steve. Most people in Bill's situation would hear us and turn us off.
Yeah. You know,
probably 99% of them.
Yeah, I agree with what you said, Steve. I'd like to add to the idea, like the celebration of skepticism on the show. You know, one thing that we also do is we're celebrating our relationship too here. Like we, you know, like a lot of our listeners know, we have all been family and friends for a very long time, and you know, we speak this way with each other in private as well. Like we're, you know, this is the way we are with each other, and the kind of stuff we talk about. So we are definitely unguarded. And
but I think that's part of the charm of our show as well.
Yeah, that is. Well, that
it's
is
unscripted. It's open, and you know, we have to keep it real. You know, to some extent, we have to be ourselves. And you know, while we try to focus on cogent arguments, facts, and logic, and be, you know, understanding, you know, and rather than insular, there's also an edginess to our discussions that, you know, we know that we're risking offending people sometimes. But I think if we sucked all of the life out of our show in order to never offend anybody, it wouldn't be the same. Right.
We do like to have fun, and we do have similar senses of humor, which I think comes through in the show as well and adds to the flavor.
Right. Definitely. I wonder, was Bill listening when Perry was on?
Yeah. Perry absolutely didn't care about offending people. I mean, and somehow that was charming, though.
He pulled that off. I don't know.
However, Perry also could turn the charisma way down and just be really nasty, and he didn't do it on the show, but I've seen Perry, wow. When Perry pulled out the knife and wanted to cut someone with words, he could do it.
Yeah.
And he was expert at it.
Right. But he never did it based on anyone's, you know, religion, faith, belief system or anything like that.
It was more stupidity.
One of his closest friends is an ordained priest.
Well, he married a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
You know, he shocked all of us.
That says a lot. I forgot about that.
Wow. Right? No, Perry didn't care. Perry, you know, just he cared about what people, you know, how they argued. But yeah, he was high tolerance for people having whatever belief systems they have. Well, let's go on. One more email. This one's actually a named out logical fallacy. And this one comes from Giles Corey, who writes, also a religious theme to this question. As I've listened to all your programs, I've noticed that whenever the Roman Catholic Church expresses its doctrine regarding the sanctity of human life, usually in the context of embryonic stem cell research, one or more rogues frequently makes some comment about the Church's sorry history of child sexual abuse, related cover-ups, and subsequent legal cases, as if the Church's horrible failure in one area robs it of all credibility on other issues. This strikes me as some sort of logical fallacy, but is it an ad hominem, poisoning the well, a red herring, or a generic fallacy? He actually wrote a genetic fallacy. I'm assuming he meant generic. Love your shows. Keep up the great work. Giles Curry from Salem, Massachusetts. So thanks, Giles. Or is it Giles, do you think?
Go with Giles. Go with Giles.
Giles? You like Giles better?
Giles. Because of Buffy.
So, yeah, this is an interesting name, not logical fallacy, partly because it's kind of turned back on us. I think what Giles is describing is closest to poisoning the well. Right. If you're saying if you made the argument that the church's stance on stem cell therapy or stem cell research is wrong or shouldn't be taken seriously because of the child sexual abuse scandals, that would be an ad hominem logical fallacy. If you're just trying to say, you know, we shouldn't be taking them seriously, that's kind of a poisoning the well, which is very closely related to ad hominem. But I don't think that we're doing that in either case. And this is why. When we've brought up that point, it's specifically to point out the fact that the church is often inconsistent in how they apply their own moral rules, right? So if they're saying, if they're justifying their stance on stem cell research with a certain morality, but then they turn around and in another context, they actually turn away from those same, you know, moral premises, that shows an inconsistency, an internal inconsistency. And I think that's absolutely valid to point that out. It doesn't mean they're wrong about stem cells. It just means that they're not even being consistent in the application of their own rules, their own justification. So there's probably something with their own arguments, right, if they're not being consistent in how they apply their premises. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's these moral issues, you know, in which they're is not, you know, we're not dissecting something that's purely scientific here. You know, there's a huge moral component to the question
right.
of embryonic stem cell research and how that relates into different people's worldviews.
Yeah. But this is, you know,
so it's tricky.
Yeah, it is tricky. And, you know, so we often will get feedback. We've dealt with this before, but it's worth mentioning again, because we still on a regular basis get feedback where, because we call somebody a name, or we, you know, we characterize somebody as being gullible or whatever, or crank, that's an ad hominem logical fallacy. And it's important to point out that it's only a logical fallacy if you put it in the context of somebody is wrong because of some negative attribute that they have. Mm-hmm. But just saying that they have a negative attribute isn't a logical fallacy, right? And poisoning the well is the same thing, but even a little bit trickier, in my opinion. Like, just previously, we were talking about Lloyd Pye, and I pointed out that he wrote the book, you know, Everything You Know Is Wrong. Yeah. That doesn't mean that the Star Child is not a human-alien hybrid, right? But it means... But
it does put him in context a little bit better, doesn't he?
Exactly.
Doesn't
it puts it into context. The guy who apparently, you know, came into the possession of this skull and is overseeing the research has a lot of really wacky ideas about science. And that shows us that there's some systematic flaw in his methodology. And that absolutely is a legitimate context to put this in. If the evidence were there, it would trump that, right? I mean, if it were objective, verifiable, transparent evidence, that will trump everything. But while we're trying to get a handle on this story and how seriously we should take it, that absolutely is a meaningful context and not, I don't think, poisoning the well. But we frequently get that feedback. It's a little bit trickier than I think a lot of people think. Well, we had originally recorded an interview with Eugenie Scott for this week's episode, but unfortunately, due to technical problems related to my fried power supply we talked about earlier in the show, the interview did not come through. So we are going to play an interview that we did at TAM 7 with George Rabb, and we will have Eugenie Scott on the show soon. We are sitting at TAM 7, and we are joined now by George Rabb. George, welcome back to the Skeptics Guy.
Oh, has it been a year?
It has. Is that amazing?
That was a long year.
It's been a year since we sat here and cried over dead.
Yeah, no tears.
That's right. I was about to
first
bring
topic.
That up.
First thing we're going to bring up, really? Happy days. Happy days.
We should mention, you know, it was the first time we had George on the show. Mm. And that was one of the biggest shows we ever did, popularity-wise. We got so many emails from people who loved you.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Yeah. And I know a lot of people talked about that having a certain impact on people in similar situations.
Yeah. So. Everybody was broken down crying in their car and on the train.
Well, you know, sometimes these podcasts and some of the subjects we talk about, they don't shine very much on the human angle of things, the emotion, the heart.
Day-to-day, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a special treat when we can touch on those things, and they are germane and relevant.
Yeah, and the only really sad part is that album is still not released yet, so I'm still working on it, which is its own level of sadness. Oh. But we're working on it, so yeah, that song will be available very, very soon.
But that gets to the bigger issue. I think, Rebecca, you were talking about this on another interview, that we need more artists in the skeptical movement, you know, and because music and other forms of art directly jack into our emotions more than purely intellectual arguments.
Right,
do.
Right. Yeah, hopefully. Not just artists. I mean, that's something that we talk about. I get asked all the time. You know, I think that comes up often in panel questions, too. What can I do? Someone will say that. Okay, yeah, I live in whatever, Topeka. What can I do? And I always say, whatever your skill set is, whatever that thing is that you do, someone needs you to do that within our community,
right.
Whether it's stuffing envelopes or putting labels on things or being a doorman or you know, designing a website or whatever it is. My particular skill set is, I can, you know, write a song every now and then and maybe be an MC for a talent show, let's say. That happens to be my thing, and I will gladly give my time to the community. But yeah, the importance of art, hopefully, is paramount in any culture, and the skeptical movement shouldn't be free of that just because it's a, you know, scientifically based thing. And I think you can make your point so much more effectively sometimes through a joke or a song or a lyric or a picture or a movie or a whatever.
Absolutely.
You know, humor to me is still the best delivery system for information. Most of what I know about European history and philosophy is through Monty Python. And it's just, you know, I will never, never not know the Philosopher's Song, you know, and be able to sing that and know who these people are and that they're philosophers. So, you know, that is how I learned most of what I learned about, you know, history in general, is through that kind of stuff. So
I agree. We were talking at the science-based medicine panel. We played the homeopathy skit, the Mitchell and Webb look. Have you seen that?
Oh, yes.
And in 2.5 minutes of humor, they did more to probably change minds about homeopathy than me writing about it for a year. You know,
because it's not the preaching thing.
Yeah.
I think sometimes information comes across as preachy, even in the best of intentions, you know. And so a defensive mechanism always gets raised, whereas when it's entertainment, people want to give you, often they want to give you the opportunity to entertain them. So that wall comes down.
So, you know, you're still working on the album and
yes.
getting that out. What else have you got going on?
Well, there's always the funk band, which is sort of the working thing. The album we're working on, and then the podcast. We have this, the weekly Geologic podcast, which is still trucking along. We're at episode 122.
Jeez.
Yeah, which we just put up this week. I was just saying this before. The podcast is something that I've done. How can I put this? It's the most consistent thing I've done in my life ever, apart from, you know, brushing my teeth.
Breathing and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, breathing, yeah. You know, apart from some kind of cleaning. Well, that too, yeah, but that's, yeah.
You didn't have to go there.
Did you ever think, like, when you were 13 and, like, you know, just whipping it into a frenzy that at almost 40 you'd still be doing that? Did you ever get to that point? Could you imagine, like, as a kid, you're sitting there, really?
I was like, I'm going to do this the rest of my life.
Really?
Why aren't I doing this every hour?
I thought this will hold me over until, like, you know, maybe some relationship kicks in.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
But, like,
other people would be doing that, not me.
Right. Yeah. And you catch yourself at 38 in the shower going, like, okay, well, okay, you know what? I'm okay with this, but it is surprising.
Maybe it's different for girls, because the first time I did it, I was like, well, I don't need boys.
Yeah.
You know, guys
funny. It's funny because I said the same thing.
Yeah, when we did the interview last year, I actually don't remember if I listened to your podcast before I ever did that interview.
I believe I was the only one, the only George fan.
But in the last year, I think I've listened to every one of your podcasts
really? Oh
in the last year. I've definitely,
yeah.
I have to say, your podcast is one of my favorite to listen to.
Oh, thank you.
And it's a performance piece. It really is.
Yeah.
You know, it's awesome.
And it's a kind word for crap.
No, I mean, it is. It's like,
it's
wow.
It's art. It's more art as opposed to good. We shoot more for conceptual as opposed to actually entertaining.
By what I mean, you do a lot of post-production, it seems.
Yeah.
You do a lot more, like, mixing in sounds. And I say, wow, I like the way you did that. I mean, you know, even just like Ask George and you have like different barking dogs or something.
Right.
I could see there's sort of there is an artistic element, I think, to every little piece that you throw in there.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's sort of a radio show type thing that's kind of post-produced a little bit. And there are recurring bits, which I enjoy, Religious Morning of the Week. Ask George, which again is a very humble, you know, lousy call-in kind of show thing. My most popular, or one of my most favorite bits is Gio's mom reads Jay-Z lyrics.
Yes.
Where, you know, my actual mother calls in and she reads lyrics from Jay-Z, and then it's just an excuse for us to kind of, you know, BS together and just talk about what's going on. I did a live, the first time ever we did a live one where she called in to Balticon, and everyone was so excited, you know, they're like, oh, George's mom is calling, she's calling. And that was great, and she was nervous, and it was very nice. To get back to what I was saying, just the consistency of it and how I've done, you know, I think I've skipped in 2 years. Last week, I skipped a show because I was getting my Element presentation ready. But apart from that, I think I've skipped one other show in the 2.5 years.
Slacker.
I tell you, yeah, it's crazy. But it's such a nice – just to have that be reason to continue.
Yeah.
I'm of that whatever – I don't know if it's a manic personality or whatever it is, or
anal.
I don't know if it's anal. It's some kind of retention, yeah. Because I'm not anal in it by any. I know I look anal, but I'm really not.
You look put together.
Put together, okay.
Yeah. You're right.
I want some put together action later, but that is enough to kind of continue to do it week after week, and then you have a fan base. Like you guys know, I mean, you feel not beholden, but
it's a hungry
feel,
beast that constantly needs feeding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it is your pet.
Did I say that out loud? I'm
just, yeah, yeah. No. Yeah. It is, but it is an animal that you get something out of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know?
Yeah.
So it's very rewarding. The instant gratification of posting a show and, 6, 10, 12 hours later you have comments, hopefully. People will write something, positive, negative, for the most part. I mean, the comments I get on the podcast site itself are some of the best comments. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're so smart and fun and funny. You guys know. And it's so, let alone the emails I get.
Yeah.
I mean, I just talked about this where someone sent me an email after hearing a show of mine who was an artist who was having trouble painting. He was sort of blocked. He had no good ideas. And he put my show on and he heard sort of a moment of joy within something I was doing. And he realized that I was doing it just to do it. And just that was enough of a payment. That joy was enough. And he got his stuff out and started painting. I mean, talking about tears, I was tearing up because it was like, how dare I have that kind of an influence on someone, a stranger.
But it's true that you're very inspiring just to me, mostly in the idea that you take a medium, you take this a podcast that's been done over and over and over again in 100 different formats, and you turn it on its head and you manage to do something creative with it and artistic.
Right.
And personally speaking, that's one of the reasons why I love to listen to it, because like Steve said, you listen and you're like, wow, I never would have thought to do that.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
I like to reward people that pay attention. I like to keep people guessing, and you can never make an assumption as to what's coming up next. I mean, just 2 weeks ago I did a show that was Ukrainian songs,
yes,
and me with an accent sort of talking about weird stuff. No introduction, no outro, and I knew that the listener would kind of be waiting, like, when is the intro going to happen? When
exactly.
is the intro going to – where is the – to do that, remotely, it was a sense of power, which is kind of fun, but also just – future episodes, you will never know what's coming next, and I just love that.
And
I love that.
You're treating the audience like they're intelligent people.
Exactly.
I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah, hopefully. And I want that kind of a listener. Someone else who wants to have a formatted show that's the same every week, and that's totally your prerogative if you enjoy having...
We kind of like that, actually.
Yeah. No, I mean,
it's easier.
And it totally makes sense. It totally makes sense. What's nice for me is that little bit of ADD that maybe I have, it provides, okay, I don't want to do a religious moron this week.
Yeah.
I would rather, speak backwards. Okay, so the next 5 minutes we're going to be talking backwards. Okay, how do we do that? And again, it's that direct sometimes where I'll just get off on a whim. Donna, Misinformation, who's my sort of partner, tech person, she'll see me doing this stuff and just be like, where is this coming from? I'm like, you need material. It comes from somewhere. So
I just wanted to let you know that the on Facebook, the number one podcast that people tell me to listen to is yours, as if I need to hear that. But
nice.
Have you heard of this? Have you just
as if
this?
You didn't weep together just a year ago.
I cried in his lap last year, okay? I think I know he has a podcast.
That's nice to know. Wow.
Yeah.
How addictive is Facebook, man?
Forget it.
To be able to put stuff up.
Are we Facebook friends?
I don't know. I think so.
Should be.
Yeah,
get on that.
Cool. It's the whole thing. Again, that instant feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about this last year. I used to put an album out once every 2 years and have to wait for months to months to get some response.
Right.
Now it's you put a podcast out 12 hours later. Now you put something in your status bar.
Right.
You get 50 responses to it. Just finished, writing Ruthenium. So you'll get, boom. And it's like, my personality is such that it's a dangerous place to be in. That kind of like, love me personality that please say it's okay.
We're like 10 years away from literally being wired into each other.
Oh, right? It's coming.
It's coming.
I think, I mean, they talk about having the equivalent of Google, sort of a wireless Google in your head, which will redefine what knowledge is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It'll be more about how you use it as opposed to what you know.
Yeah.
Upgrading might be a problem, but
a friend of mine said,
I won't be the first to put it in, but I'll put it in.
I'll be the first. I've said this many times, and Steve will edit this probably. I want my iPhone to be surgically implanted in my head because it's a part of my being now. I've merged with my electronics.
Well, it's on its way. I mean, if you figure they get smaller and smaller, you get them to a cellular level, you get it so that it's going into some kind of direct, pineal nerve or whatever it needs to be into so that you have an ocular thing, you have an ear thing, and you just, somehow you'll be able to, again, I don't think this is any kind of a singularity BS thing. I think it's a practical, just mechanical question of having a, you know, you have a wireless feed, you know, up your butt essentially, and it's why not?
A really good friend of mine was saying, you know, he's like, you know, if we can make texting the kind of thing, if I don't have to type a text in and send it to someone, if I can think it and send it to someone, that's telepathy.
Yeah.
Well, it's already we're already as close to telepathy. You know, the fact that you hold up this little box to your face and you can talk to someone across the planet, you know, let alone texting. That's we will so sooner get to actual magic. We already have actual magic.
Right.
But anything resembling telepathy will be mechanical.
Yeah, I mean, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
I love
what you mean.
So much.
I
was going to go to Bob and go, Bob, what's that cool quote you know? And Rebecca's like, I'm a geek too.
You have to wear a Nehru jacket while you say that, though. That's the kind
But the audience can't tell that I'm using my iPhone to look it up right now. So. I'm not.
If you ever saw Ghost in the Machine, Ghost in the Machine is an animated science fiction show. Really, pretty good show. I really liked it. Everybody had, had a robo brain basically, and people, certain hackers were smart enough, they were going around hacking people's brains. So what you saw was not really there, so it was pretty interesting that you have all this great technology in your head and someone's going around just hacking.
There'll be repercussions, like there always is. There's always some price
risk
that
benefit,
we pay,
right? Risk benefit,
I mean, we'll lose privacy, we'll lose, you know, I mean, I think the annoying cell phone restaurant person will be magnified to whatever extent it will be, or maybe not. Maybe it'll be so internalized that you'll be able to have conversations
and
without.
We'll be less able to tell the schizophrenics from the people talking on their cell phones.
I have this. I have
it's
this
already
I,
bad.
I
right?
have this idea that, that cities should hand out, you know, just little phones for crazy people, so you don't feel quite as bad. Because wouldn't you, like, you see that person in the corner and you think insane, you know, homeless or cell phone? Maybe like cell phone. Oh, good, and kind of relaxed. They should just hand out little, you know, phones.
Like fake phones.
Fake phones that they just, you know, put it in the person's ear so that, okay, they have nine sweaters on, but maybe they're making a call.
George, really? George, that's your solution to, like, crazy homeless people?
I think it's a cheap, it's not a solution. It's just to make myself feel better, which is the most
important
thing.
So you can ignore them easier.
It's just a way to mollify the situation so he feels better.
What we can do is then, since they have the phones, we can connect homeless people in different cities and they can talk to each other as if they're actually having a conversation. So you have Boston homeless crazy people talking to New York homeless people, and maybe they can invent some kind of a hive mind, you know, across the entire country.
Right. And they take over the planet.
Yeah, well, that's just it. Yeah, it becomes this automaton.
Sure.
But the big problem now is people with the cell phones in the ear. So they're talking on the cell phone, but they're not holding a cell phone up to their head. So
yeah,
you think
Steve, that's what we've been talking about the last 10 minutes, actually.
Yeah, no, but he was comparing the cell phone people to the no cell phone people, but now you have cell phone people who you can't tell have a cell phone.
Right.
Yeah,
but
we know now. We know the body posture. We know the head tilt.
But
we,
there isn't much of one, though. There is when you're holding a cell phone to your head, but there isn't much of a posture or head tilt when you're talking into your earpiece. It can be
Bluetooth
indistinguishable.
People at work have these, you know, just ear devices, and they're walking around work doing their things. And if the way you know that if they're on the phone or not, they'll put their hand on their head, walk around.
Really?
I'm on the phone. Yeah, that's what they do. That's what they do. This means I'm on the phone.
I'm not crazy.
It's just my hand on my head.
You know what I want? I want a big flashing red siren light on my head when I'm on the phone.
Because they'll see someone coming and, like, you know, you look like they may have to engage in a conversation with a person, but it's like, okay, so I know they're on the phone.
God, that's the perfect way to dodge someone you don't want to talk to.
Oh, beautiful.
I like to, instead of using punctuation, I just use, you know, the old CB thing, you know, Roger, over. So that'll make it obvious, on phone. Instead of periods, I just say that, So how are you? On phone.
Old man.
He said that? On phone. That works for me.
That works. We have this new segment that we're doing, Who's That Noisy? And each week we play a different intro.
Okay.
And we're getting submissions from our listeners.
Okay.
But we're also soliciting submissions from, you know,
from famous people,
from musicians and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so you obviously would be perfect for it. I mean, just it's really whatever you want to do.
And all you have to say is Who's That Noisy at some point.
At some point.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Whatever. We've had submissions
90
from
seconds,
3
45.
Seconds to 90 seconds.
90 seconds.
That's probably
a bit long.
That's a bit long. Some guy said, I got like a 5-minute thing. I'm like, can you cut that down a little?
But what's our
We appreciate the enthusiasm.
Right.
Believe me.
My favorite's a 5-year-old little kid.
The little British kid.
British kid.
Oh,
yeah.
That noisy. He was great.
Well, because the kid was brilliantly and adorably English.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
When I was in London, the cutest thing I ever heard was, well, I was in London a couple years ago, and the best compliment I ever got was one person asked me for directions, which was like, thank you. Do you know which way is the, I'm looking for the... And I said, I'm from New Jersey. I'm sorry.
New Jersey. Is that near Liverpool?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Jersey.
So that was the first thing. But this little girl, you know, as I was sort of defraying the request, this woman walked by and she had leopard print like stretch pants.
Awesome.
So she walked by in one direction, and there was a woman with her daughter walking in the other direction. And the little girl looked at the lady and she said, "Mommy, that lady looks like a tiger." And I just melted. I was like, oh, I am in Great Britain.
Yeah.
Oh, so nice.
I've got to go there so bad.
Nice. Yeah. Totally. Totally. Yeah.
Well, George, it's always a pleasure. You have to, you know, do this more often than once a year.
Yes, yeah. Please. Anytime. Yeah. I, you know, being a musician, it's nice because I essentially, you know, work Friday, Saturday. So that allows me to do the 37 other projects that I do. So
awesome.
Anytime, because it's a real honor, and please keep doing what you're doing. And
ditto.
You guys
are
always the same thing. People that listen to my show all the time. Well, of course, SGU. And it's like you don't have to say it. Yeah. So thank you for doing what you guys do.
Oh, God,
and it means everything. So
Thank you, George.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a special science or fiction this week. We have four items, and these are all little known facts about scientists.
Got it.
All right. Again, three true, one fake. Ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
Item number one, Benjamin Franklin published Poor Richard's Almanac under the alter ego of a poor man named Richard Saunders. Item number two, Susan Jocelyn Bell Burnell is credited with the discovery of pulsars, rotating neutron stars, but her advisor, Anthony Hewish, was awarded the Nobel Prize for the discovery. Item number three, Galileo Galilei became blind later in life as a consequence of looking at sunspots through his telescope. Item number four, Louis Pasteur refused to shake anyone's hand for fear of catching germs.
Oh.
Bob, go first.
Okay. Benjamin Franklin. So we use a pen name, Richard Saunders. That name rings a bell, Richard Saunders. I'll come back to that. Susan Jocelyn Bell. Yeah, she discovered pulsars, and it's funny. Her advisor being the Nobel Prize. Wow, I could see that happen. I guess how terrible would that be if you actually do it and your silly advisor gets it instead of you? Wow. That's going back to the was that the 60s? I think. Yeah, maybe I could see maybe a little sexism even back in the 60s with that. Possibly, I don't know. Galileo, I seem to remember him having bad sight, studying sunspots through his telescope. Wait, are you implying that he's got no filter?
I'm not implying that at all. No.
Okay. I don't know about that one. Pasteur, catching germs. That's kind of funny. This is tough. I'm gonna go with Galileo. I don't think that doesn't sound right to me. And I mean, don't they just reflect an image of the sun onto a surface of something and to look at the sunspots? You're not actually looking directly through it back then, not through a primitive telescope, but the sun. That's rubbing me the wrong way for some reason. I'm going to say Galileo is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay. Benjamin Franklin published Poor Richard's Almanac under the alter ego of poor man named Richard Saunders. That is correct. Susan Jocelyn Bell Burnell, credited with discovery of pulsars. Her advisor was awarded the Nobel Prize for the discovery. Wow. I don't know about that. The Galileo Galilei one, I do remember reading that he did go blind or partially blind, but wasn't he in prison at the time?
The house arrest?
Yeah, he was in house arrest. Oh, if he was in house arrest, then he would still have access to his stuff, right? Yeah, that totally rings a bell, but you know that the wrinkle of how he went blind.
Yeah.
That's really good, Steve. Louis Pasteur refused to shake anyone's hand for fear of catching germs. I mean, man, that's awesome. And it sounds that sounds familiar too. The only one I'm not sure about, for real not sure, is number two. I mean, I'm trying to do the GWB routine. You know, go with Bob.
Just use your own
knowledge and experience.
All right, I'm going to go with my gut.
The force, Jay.
My gut said to me that I think I would have known if Galileo went blind because of looking at sunspots. And I think that one is fake, and the Bob thing affected me by 50%. There you go.
Okay, Evan?
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking about, too. Of all of these, I'm pretty sure about the Benjamin Franklin one, Richard Saunders. I don't quite remember that last name, but I think that's right. And then the Susan Jocelyn Bell Burnell one. I knew about that. I didn't realize her advisor won the award, and I didn't know his name was Anthony Hewish because he doesn't look Hewish. And but I didn't see the Galileo Galilei being blind coming my way. I'm throwing in as many puns here, but I'm running out. So I'll go with the crowd. Galileo. Fiction.
Okay, follower. All right, let's go take this in order. Benjamin Franklin published Poor Richard's Almanac under the alter ego of a poor man named Richard Saunders. And that one is science.
Science.
Who knew Richard Saunders was so famous? I had to use that one because of the name, obviously.
Yeah, I knew that one. Absolutely knew that one.
Really? Cool, yeah. Jay.
Even you knew the name Richard Saunders?
I did. I mean, I did right now as you said it. I'm like, oh, yeah.
He had so many publishing pseudonyms. He was great that way. He was able to take on the personality of the people that he would write as, you know, like 30
characters. It was a common practice, and it enabled famous people, you know, to speak more freely because they were writing under an alter ego. Mm-hmm. Yep. Let's go on to item number two. Susan Jocelyn Bell Burnell is credited with the discovery of pulsars, but her advisor, Anthony Hewish, was awarded the Nobel Prize for the discovery. And that one is science.
Oh, man. That's man. What a...
She got the...
Bob,
that
she stinks.
Got the harsh.
Yeah.
She got the Bob, we won this week.
Oh, well...
Yeah, clean sweep, Dave.
I don't know. Hasn't been determined yet.
No, I know it.
1974, Anthony Hewish shared the Nobel Prize with Sir Martin Ryle, also from Cambridge, and Jocelyn Bell was completely ignored.
Because she was a student or something, Steve? Is that why?
Yeah, she was, you know, junior to him in the lab. Now, generally speaking, you know, you're the senior researcher, the advisor, would you know, gets to soak off the credit from whoever working underneath them, the work that they do. But the person working underneath them doesn't get completely ignored or left out. Right, they get credit too.
Sure, yeah.
And it's largely considered that, you know, because she was a woman and it was the 1960s when this happened, although again the Nobel Prize wasn't until the 1970s, that played a role in her being completely ignored in the Nobel Prize. Very similar, in fact, to many other science heroines who were ignored in their work. I think the most famous one is probably Rosalind Franklin. You guys know what she contributed to?
Mint.
Her X-ray images of atoms were very critical in the discovery of the double helix of DNA by Watson and Crick. But she also was completely asked out of the Nobel Prize or of any recognition until much later, you know. And then she died young, and it really wasn't until after she died that she really started to get credit, you know, for her role in the discovery.
Too late.
Let's go on to number three.
Ooh.
Galileo Galilei became blind later in life as a consequence of studying sunspots through his telescope. You guys all think that one is the fiction.
Yes, we do, Steve.
Hmm. And that one is...
Say it.
Fiction.
Yes.
Yeah, baby.
Bob, thank you.
That's what my gut told me.
GWB.
Galileo did indeed go blind later in life, and it is a common myth that it was from looking at sunspots.
It was from
However, that is almost certainly not true. Most of his sunspot gazing was many, many years before he went blind, and it is believed that he almost certainly went blind through either glaucoma or cataracts.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Didn't he also have other really bad... He had, like, a couple of other things that were going wrong at the time. He was pretty sick at that point.
Well, you know, he lived a long time ago, and he lived to an old age in his 70s. And,
wow.
You know, if you were in your 70s in the 1500s, I'm sure there was a ton of stuff wrong with you. I mean,
beat
you know...
the curve at that point, that's for sure.
Didn't exactly have effective health care back then. But, yeah.
Ha-ha.
Which means that Louis Pasteur refused to shake anyone's hand for fear of catching germs is science. Guy
That's
was
great.
A
foresight.
What's that show? Monk. You guys watch Monk?
Yeah.
Tony Shalhoub. Guys like totally neurotic, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's ironic, you know, Pasteur was phobic about germs.
I don't think it's ironic at all. It's smart. it makes perfect sense.
I guess so. I guess from a certain point of view. So good job, everyone. I thought that would be a bit tricky. You know?
It was a bit tricky. There was enough to think about there.
Yeah, it still was, Steve, just because
You zeroed in on the Galileo.
Yeah.
So, Jay, can you please regale us with a skeptical quote?
Yes, I will. This quote was sent in by Alexis Coleman on Facebook. I've been really lucky with people sending me good quotes because I haven't been finding any that I like. And this is a quote from Harry Houdini. I don't think I've quoted Harry Houdini before. Harry said, or wrote, "My brain is the key that sets my mind free." Harry Houdini.
That was good.
That's good. That's a good. Yeah, we definitely, Houdini deserves to be quoted.
Okay, so a quick message. We'd like to send a shout out to our friends at Connecticut Drinking Skeptically and their monthly meetup group. And if you go to the website, skeptics.meetup.com, you will find them. And they have another meeting come up on April 15th. And they're pretty good about having these every month and a good selection of speakers and presenters. So for those of you
who's the speaker on the 15th,
to be determined as soon as they get the venue settled. So that information is coming soon, probably in the next week or so. So just tune into the website and you'll have all the information there.
It's not impossible that a rogue may be showing up at these meetings from time to time.
I may have suggested that perhaps I might show up to the next meeting. We'll see how it goes. It is just 2 days before Nexus, but, and I know some of the folks from Drinking Skeptically will be coming to Nexus.
Steve, what's this Nexus thing I keep hearing about?
The Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. This is the second such conference. Jay will be appearing naked live on stage.
It will happen that morning at some point. I may be alone in my bathroom.
Right, we're calling this the Nexus 2010, the full Monty.
Well, in my case, that'd be a half Monty, Steve.
Okay.
Or the Peroni Monty, but.
Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
Our pleasure.
Well done. Thanks, Steve.
Hopefully next week we won't have any more computer problems.
Let's hope.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.